Almost live from an undisclosed crypt in the state of Transylvania with its 20 electoral votes, it's time for Chatter on Books. I'm your part-time announcer and sometimes fill-in guest, Jamie McIntyre, and here's your host, Tori Clark.
Thanks, Jamie McIntyre. Love having you back with us. Love your voice as ever. Thanks, everybody, for coming back to Chatter on Books. We've got a lot to cover tonight, and we are going to be talking to Jess Walter in a few minutes, who is a really fabulous, incredible author. He's the kind of person, when I tell my friends we've got Jess Walter on the show coming up, they go, how did you ever get Jess Walter? Which he might be asking himself in a few minutes. If you haven't read Beautiful Ruins, you should go out and get that right away, which is on the New York Times bestseller list for 1,000 weeks. And he's back with a new book called The Cold Millions, which I thought was just fascinating. Got a couple other things on tap. I have a couple random thoughts. I have a question for Jamie, Mr. National Security, and a quick debate about Matthew McConaughey's new book. That's not as silly as it sounds. But Jamie, first up for you, Mr. Covered National Security for decades and decades. I was talking with some friends recently and they said, oh, you used to work at the Pentagon. How seriously should we take foreign interference in elections? And I'll tee you up with this. I remember back in the days when I was at the Pentagon and you were there, some smart person, wasn't you and it wasn't me, but some smart person said at the time, so this is almost 20 years ago, that at that time, every single day, there were 1,000 legitimate, credible attempts by the Chinese to hack into the Pentagon systems. So that wasn't accounting for trying to hack into all the other government systems or commercial systems, et cetera. But the Chinese attempts to hack into our systems was big back then. I assume it's even bigger and more sophisticated now. But how seriously should we take foreign attempts to hack into our systems, whether they be DOD systems or election systems?
Well, you probably heard about both Russia and Iran getting access to some of the voter registration data and then using that in various ways to try to influence voters.
Yeah.
For the most part, that data is publicly available. We still have no evidence of anybody hacking into a secure system and changing votes or doing something, you know, like that, where you can actually steal the election. But people are influenced by all these things that go on social media. And part of this data is used to target people.
Sure.
I'm sure you heard about the letters that were purportedly from the Proud Boys that were threatening people in Florida and other places that if they didn't vote for President Trump, they would
come and get them.
Would come and get them. And the interesting thing about that was both sides claimed that benefited the other candidate.
Right.
Obviously one of them said, well, you know, they're going to intimidate people to vote for Trump. And the other one was like, they're clearly making it look like Trump is the beneficiary. So that was interesting. A couple of other things that were really interesting. Did you see, by the way, that a Dutch computer expert claimed that he got President Trump's Twitter password?
No.
Did you see this? No, he claimed the password was, he guessed it. He said it was MAGA 2020 with an exclamation point.
Oh, I've tried that one before. It doesn't work.
And he said, well,
I don't think that's it.
And a version of that is also apparently used for Wi-Fi at some of the rallies. But he claimed he got in. Apparently, he's a credible guy. Claimed he got in. Claimed he tried to warn the Trump campaign. Tried to tell the White House that the account wasn't secure. And then he got no response. But then a couple of days later, they added two-factor authentication to them.
Oh, there we go.
So they couldn't get back in. But, you know, even if a small number of votes were influenced by some nefarious means, it's still a tiny fraction of the number of votes that are cast. And one of the things that people don't realize is that every election has a margin of error because there's humans involved in counting and tabulating all these votes. So if you have an election like you had in 2000, where, you know, 500 votes split the two candidates in Florida, really, it's a statistical tie. Because if you counted them all over again, which of course they didn't do in Florida in 2000, count them all over again, you get a slightly different result. You did it again, you get a slightly different result. It's kind of like you taking a deck of cards and counting to see if all 52 are there. And the first time you go through, there's only 51, and then the next time it's not. So,
but to push back on you, in an age in which, I mean, think about 2016, in which Hillary Clinton lost Pennsylvania by 40,000 votes, next to nothing, right? In an age in which small numbers can make a big difference, if disinformation put out there very sophisticatedly by the Russians or the Chinese, whomever, moves 15,000, 20,000 people, that's a lot.
So one of the big differences is that a lot of people weren't as motivated to vote 4 years ago. They didn't like either candidate. They thought, you know, it's not going to make any difference. Let's, you know, why should I even bother to vote? Or I'm going to vote for a third party candidate, which, mm-hmm. you know, in, I forget which state it was. I think it was Wisconsin. Hillary Clinton lost by less than what the votes that Jill Stein got in Wisconsin. So, and there's not really a big third party candidate. You know, I'm not dissing Kanye West, but there really isn't another big alternative. And people are really motivated. The big factor, I think, is people are worried about is when you have mail-in ballots, you have a certain number that are rejected.
Anyways, and have been for years.
Because they have signature mismatches or they forgot to sign it or they didn't put it in the right envelope or something. And so when you have many, many more mail-in or drop-off ballots, that error factor magnifies.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking about these states that have the, you know, your signature has to match the one on file. I have no idea what my signature looked like when I registered.
When you applied for your driver's license.
You know, who knows?
I think, David, you probably remember it was 3 or 4 years ago and Kanye West was bad. We were on the Tony Kornheiser show and Kanye West was babbling and said he was going to run for president in 2020. And I said, oh, I hope he does, because nothing will make me happier than to see, because I probably won't like whoever the candidates will be. And if I see Kanye's name on a ballot, I'll just have to vote for him. But I voted. I was the earliest person in the state of Maryland voting. And I went over and took pictures of myself dropping my ballot in the box, you know, the ironclad box. So I did not get to vote for Kanye, but it was enticing. It was very enticing. David, do you guys worry much about hacking and things like that at The Athletic?
No.
Is it a problem at all?
Not that I've noticed. Sometimes the issue is when you sometimes have these Reddits and some of these public meet and greets that your reporters have. And lots of people who've been on Zoom have gotten these terrible racist bombings from white supremacist groups. And we've had a couple of incidents similar with some of our writers. But into the actual system, no, because number one, it's such a low value target. I can't imagine anybody would spend any amount of time or money trying to hack it. You know, it's more to me, it's just, I'm much more concerned about counting the votes than someone changing the votes. To me, that's what I worry about. I think there's more than enough votes for one candidate, my preferred candidate. It's just a matter of whether those votes are going to get counted or not.
Well, since this show is loosely about books and things to read, I always say to people, read the Mueller report. If you haven't read the Mueller report, most people probably don't remember the Mueller report. Read it, not for any political reasons, but it will scare the living daylights out of you about what the Russians can do and are trying to do. Yeah. And also Donna Brazile, who was one of the first authors we had on the show with her book Hacks, which I don't think ever got the attention it deserved because, again, it was nothing political. And I think a fair number of people, Republicans, probably said, I'm not going to read that because she's a big Democrat. But it was so much about be scared, be very scared about what they're trying to do and how good they are at it. So that's my reading
recommendation. And it's scary that you have to win by such a large margin that it can't be, it can't be, if not turned over, it can't be diminished by people who would say that it's not fair in this.
Yeah.
So someone who should win, you know, 52-48 has to win 56-44 for people to believe it. And that's just that's a big lift in this country these days. Yeah. It's a lot to ask of anybody.
I don't know about you guys, but I've canceled everything next week from Tuesday through Saturday. And I'm stockpiling wine from Calvert Woodley. I just figure I'll mainline caffeine for half the day and then just drink the rest of the day until we get this settled. Okay, Jamie, I have to ask you, what are you reading? I'm so intrigued that somebody who on the show actually wants to be asked about what they're reading.
So I'm a very impulsive reader. You know, something happens
and
I just ping off of that. And I'm as impulsive a reader as Trump is in deciding how many troops he's going to withdraw from Afghanistan. But last month, President Trump gave a speech on American history. I don't know if you caught it.
Missed it.
A lot of people missed it. But he was very upset about the left radicalization of history. He gave this speech at the archives. And he said, that this is a quote, "We must clear away the twisted web of lies in our schools and classrooms and teach our children the magnificent truth about our country. We want our sons and daughters to know they are citizens of most exceptional nation in the history of the world." And then he went off and he attacked this book, which I had read when I was in college, Howard Zim's A People's History of the United States. I don't know if you're familiar with this book.
Yes.
I read it a long time ago. And he said it was, he says, our children are instructed from propaganda tracts like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history. So this, of course, this sparked what I, you know, what's referred to as the Streisand effect. You know what that is?
No.
Yeah, the Streisand effect was Barbara Streisand had a nice house on the coast of California, I think, and a photographer, aerial photographer, took pictures of her house and posted them, and she considered it an invasion of privacy. So she sued him and said he didn't have the right to take pictures of it. Up until that point, like, you know, five people had downloaded the pictures, but once she sued him, you know, thousands of people went and downloaded the pictures. So the idea is once you call attention to something because you don't like it, like, for instance, the billboards in Times Square featuring Jared Kushner and Ivanka. So once you complain about it, then everybody knows about it and everybody goes to look for it. So I, of course, went to find my copy and I couldn't find it. So I had to get a new copy of A People's History.
Good for you.
And because I'm just kind of obviously I'm not going to read it cover to cover, but I decided to go and read the chapter about Andrew Jackson, who's one of President Trump's favorite
presidents. Favorites.
And I won't go into a lot of detail, but it was about how they evicted the Cherokee from one of the five Southern tribes. They, at the time, they called them the five civilized tribes.
Right.
And it's a very interesting story. And the Cherokee were quick to adopt the white person's ways, and they had their own constitution and their own language and a newspaper. But the interesting thing about it was how Jackson essentially ignored a Supreme Court ruling because he just didn't like it, and of course sent them on the trail of tears. So I was just reading this, you know, and the fact of the matter is our history on all sides is very mixed. One of the things I learned that I didn't remember was the Cherokee, in adopting the white man's ways, also had black slaves.
That I knew, yeah.
And the slaves were also forced to go on the, you know, 800 miles on the Trail of Tears to what's now Oklahoma. So, one interesting fun fact to know and tell is that one of the major warriors fought for the Cherokee. And by the way, the Cherokee teamed up with Jackson's forces in the Creek War. And in fact, one of the Cherokee warriors saved Andrew Jackson's life. And if he hadn't done that, who knows, maybe the Cherokee would still have their land. One of them was named Major Ridge. And he took the name Major because that was the rank he held when he was fighting with Andrew Jackson. And the region, his last name was Ridge. And you'll be interested in this, Dave. Because the Cherokees called him the man who walks on the mountaintop. And the white men interpreted that man who walks on the mountaintop as Ridge. So David, all man who walks on the mountaintop, that would be your Cherokee name if you had one.
There you go.
Because if I had a nickel for everybody who said to me, wow, you know David Aldridge, the man who walks on the ridge, I'd be very wealthy. Very wealthy. Yes. Okay, one quick random and then one quick debate, and then we're going to be talking to Jess Walter, which makes me very, very happy.
Waiting very patiently.
Probably
wondering what he got himself hooked into.
We're all waving, Jess. Okay, so Pat Conroy was born on this day in 1945 in Atlanta, and everybody knows the books, Prince of Tides, The Great Santini, et cetera, et cetera. He wrote a cookbook. Who knew that? This is one of the great things about the show is you never know what you're going to find when you're looking for something else. So I was looking up Pat Conroy. Yeah, he wrote a cookbook in 2004, and it was called One of the Very Best of Its Genre by the Paris Review, which I think is very cool. Okay, here's the debate. And we had socially distanced drinks in our neighborhood the other day, and people were talking about the show, and they said, oh, you ought to get Matthew McConaughey on. And I said, don't really want him on the show. I doubt we could, you know. But he's got his memoir out. It's called Green Lights. And just very quickly, David, Jamie, will you ever read Matthew McConaughey's memoir, Green Lights, yes or no, and why?
Not a chance in hell.
because?
I have absolutely no interest in what Matthew McConaughey has to say about anything. I'm sorry, I don't. Yeah. That's okay. He doesn't have any interest in what I have to say about anything, I'm sure.
I doubt that. I'm sure he's a fan.
It's okay. He actually likes the football team very much. He's a big fan of the football team, the local football team. But
the Washington football team? That's right.
Big fan. big fan.
Yeah,
big,
but didn't he stand on the sidelines with the owner of the Washington football
team? Yes, no, once? He's a big fan. He and Kevin Durant are the two biggest celebrity fans of the team.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
big Jamie? Fan.
So I've done the calculation like many people my age, and I'm a sexagenarian, emphasis uh-huh. on the sex. You know, I think I can read 10 books a year, maybe 20 years left. You know, I maybe 200 books I've got left. This is not going to be one of them.
Okay. I'm gonna make
that. All especially because right. I waste I'm, time reading old books over again because
exactly.
I like
them. I'm going to push back gently. And when I first heard that he even had the memoir, I was like, come on, you're 50 years old, which is a baby, right? And you're this good looking guy. And I was like, no, 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 absolutely not. And I hate those commercials where he sits in the back of the car and the little fish flag comes up. Hate those. But he's had a pretty interesting life. And I think one of the reasons he wrote this book is because this is my theory, not anything he said. It's partly therapy. He was abused as a child. He was mm-hmm. taken advantage of by women when he was coming up as a young, good looking actor. So it's a little more interesting than you might think.
Well, everybody has an interesting story.
Exactly.
I told you I'm trying to write my own memoir, and I'm not writing it for anyone to read, just my kids to have. But
yes,
but it did put me in the mind of what I didn't. I thought about why I didn't want to read it, and then what memoir would I like to read again?
You didn't want to read it. I did. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you didn't want to read it because guys resent Matthew McConaughey.
No, because no, I thought if it. I had, was going to take the time to read, I was going to read my favorite memoir, George Jones. I Live right. to Tell It All. Which
nice.
Is okay. just an amazing, you know, every memoir is trying to give like the best version of yourself. Mm-hmm. This one doesn't. And
last thing I swear. And then we're going to talk to Jess Walter before he leaves. and we talked about this the other day in the driveway, Michelle Obama's book, mm-hmm. Becoming. It's the best memoir I've ever read. And not because it's the best political memoir I've ever read, because they're usually dreadful, mm-hmm. but it's the most honest take on her life, their marriage. And it doesn't matter that he happened to become president of the United States and she was the first lady. It's just this incredibly real 21st century take on two people in a marriage. So everyone should get that book. But most importantly, Jess Walter, thanks for joining us. Welcome to Chatter on Books, finally.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're so happy to have you.
And I'm not going to read Matthew McConaughey's book, but I'm going to skip straight to the part. I'm going to go straight to the index and look up Dazed and Confused. And because I want to see if someone wrote those lines. All right.
I'm pretty sure it's in there. I think it was discussed pretty heavily. So I'm pretty sure
Pat
it's in
Conroy
there.
Pat Conroy wrote one of my favorite basketball books of all time, mm-hmm. My Losing Season.
About
playing at the Citadel and the Great Santini, which I felt like was my basketball career. My dad fucking was standing in the corner while I airballed free throws and things like that.
Oh, and did he give you a hard time about it afterwards when you went home for dinner?
No. My dad, it was so hard for him to watch me play basketball because I was kind of a smallish kid. I got a stick in my eye when I was five. My high school coach at one point, we were doing this drill and he said, Walter, why do you keep moving your head? And I said, well, I can't see out of this side. And I saw this look on his face, like, I have a one-eyed point guard. Like, that's not good. We're not going to state. So I think my dad's deep concern watching me play, and he would hit the tavern on the way there meant it would drive him crazy watching me. You know, one point I would be sitting there and he'd yell like, stop playing with your drawstrings. Cause I'd pull my drawstrings out and retie them. And I just think it was being a dad myself now, I just think it was too much pressure, but I'd gotten benched at one point and in a JV game and he walked across the court and yelled at the coach, you may be winning, but I think you're a loser, and then walked out.
That's a great line.
Oh boy.
So when I read The Great Santini, I thought, I've been there. I know what that's like. So.
How old were you when you read The Great Santini? Do you remember?
I think I must have been about 17 or 18. I was pretty young.
Yeah.
And you know, being a basketball junkie, I live in Spokane, Washington, which is like a little Indiana. Gonzaga is here, and
yeah.
You know, When you grow up playing against John Stockton and, you know, players like that, you become a basketball junkie. So I still play 3 days a week. My brother and I have invented this social distance basketball game that I'm almost undefeated at.
Wait a minute. This is an athletic story if I've ever heard
exactly,
one.
Exactly. Let's go.
Get me your contact information, sir. We're going to do
so
a piece on it.
David was there. Yeah, I'm in.
Another nickel for Tori. How does one play basketball socially distancing?
Well, you need a full court. Uh-huh. And then my brother goes to one end, I go to the other. And we basically play to 100. You get three layups, each worth 1 point a quarter, plus you have to shoot 5 free throws, also worth a point. The rest are 3-pointers because we're both outside shooters. And on an outdoor court with those double heavy rims, the ball skips all over the place. It's a great workout. So we'll play to quarters. We play to 25, so I might be up 25, 22. And then we play to 50, and then we play to 75, and then we play to 100. And we'll play the best 2 out of 3. I really feel like I'm going to come out of this pandemic and sign a 10-day contract with someone. I am playing at a level that, frankly,
for game is tight
for a 5'10" 55-year-old one-eyed point guard. I don't think anyone's ever played at this level before.
That's fabulous. I'm going to talk about your brother in a little bit, but so let's talk about Spokane. Born and raised.
Yeah,
you haven't left. Yeah, there was a game plan somewhere way back when where you're going to go to Berkeley and then you're going to go to Iowa.
Yeah.
And then something happened and kind of kept you in Spokane and made you a journalist.
Yeah, I became a teenage dad at 19. And I come from a really blue collar family. I'm the first college graduate in my family, the first male to graduate high school. My dad worked at an aluminum plant. My grandfathers were both itinerant agriculture workers who ended up one as a rancher, the other working on road crews. So I didn't have a whole lot of options. And so, you know, when you're going to school, you can't just go to work at the novel factory to support your kids. So journalism was a great path for me. And I think it actually probably made me a much better novelist and writer than all the great things about journalism. First of all, your chops. I always liken it to getting a job in a bar where you're playing piano on this terribly out of tune piano. You have to play whatever requests they put in the glass, but my God, you get your chops and you can play anything. You're not afraid of publication, but more than that, I think is a kind of curiosity about the world. My fiction is really outward looking, driven by research. And I feel like sometimes, you know, having taught at the Iowa Writers Workshop where there were terrific writers, but people show up thinking they have to just tell their own story and I feel sometimes like being a journalist, I just have such a more expansive idea of what fiction can be, you know, and that you understand systems, you have a sense of curiosity about the world that you're, you know, that you can focus into fiction writing. So I you know, a lot of the writers that I loved came through journalism, you know, growing up from William Kennedy to Joan Didion, you know, the writers that I sort of patterned myself after had a stint at newspapers. And I think it was a great training ground.
I think I read somewhere that you said you thought fiction was becoming too selfish and that there ought to be a limit on how many books can be written every year about writing, because the authors are writing about themselves, obviously. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I get a sense, sometimes I'll be reading a novel, you know, someone will send me a novel to write a blurb, and I'll have the sense that I'm watching someone's social media feed, or that I'm watching over their shoulder as they play a first person shooter game. You know, there's that kind of that sort of claustrophobia of, and I do this, then I do that. Or, you know, if you're watching like a reality TV show and they ask, you know, the cooking people, well, what were you thinking at this point? You know, I was thinking this. We have this sort of language now. You know, we I think are sort of sick with narcissism, and I think it starts at the very top. You know, with that guy whose password is apparently MAGA 2020. You know,
I tried that one. What's
with an exclamation point?
With an exclamation
point. Yeah, that boxes them every time. That
I used to give credit to the person who said this, and I first read it, and I don't give credit anymore because I can't remember. But the joke is, why are all these social media platforms called things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, et cetera? Because narcissism is just too hard to spell.
Yeah.
I think it's perfect. Yeah, so you make the shift from the most nonfiction of nonfiction journalism to fiction. What was there any difficulty in making that transition?
Yeah. I mean, my very first book was a book of nonfiction, of journalistic nonfiction about the shootout at Ruby Ridge.
Right.
And that was another area that another kind of writing I'd always been fascinated by. And, In Cold Blood was a book that I had just loved, The Executioner song.
Great
I had
book.
Wanted to write one of those big, meaty pieces of narrative nonfiction. And so you're a 25-year-old reporter covering a shootout on a mountaintop between FBI agents and a white separatist family. I just said, this is my book. You know, I think I'd been on an airplane twice. I'd never been east of Wyoming. I had no agent, and I started peddling a book in New York. And, weirdly, sometimes those stories work out. And the book came out in 1995, and that kind of got me into publishing.
Yeah. Why did the name change of the book?
So it was initially called Every Knee Shall Bow. I wrote it before the, and I called it that before the bombing at Oklahoma City. Uh-huh. After the courthouse at Oklahoma City was bombed, everyone all of a sudden, because no one knew about this case in the Northwest. It was really just a regional case.
Yeah.
But after that, everyone sort of knew about Ruby Ridge, and a couple of kind of right-wing journalists or commentators had books called Standoff at Ruby Ridge and Ruby Ridge something, where they pretty much just, cribbed my reporting. And so the publisher for a paperback version said, look, why don't we update the book? Every Knee Shall Bow will still exist, but why don't we update the book and use this title so that people looking for this event can find it.
Gotcha.
So at the time I had misgivings, but I do sort of think of them almost as, I think of the updated book as a very different one.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay, let's fast forward to what we really want to talk about tonight, which is The Cold Millions. But I've got to bring your brother back into this. And yeah. David and Jamie will really appreciate this. So it was the Spokesman Review, and they asked your brother, Ralph, to write something about you surrounding the coming out of the new book, The Cold Millions. And I'm just going to read some sections of it. And then I have a question particularly for David. So
you need to know that in our culture, we are roasters. That's what we do.
That's clear.
Express love is by saying the worst things possible about each other. So
this is sections of something Ralph wrote about his brother, Jess. It's in the Spokesman Review. I highly recommend you Google it.
And there are photos of us playing basketball.
Really cute photos. He's much bigger than you.
Let's not bring that up.
How much younger is he?
He's 4 years younger, 7 inches taller, and infinitely stupider. So
he's a pretty good writer, though. So these are just sections.
He
talks about a lot of stuff. Let's start with his novels, meaning his older brother's novels. Obviously, we'll skip the first two, Over Tumbled Graves from 2001 and Land of the Blind, 2003. It's been so long since I pretended to read them that I've completely forgotten what I was told they were about, which is pretty good. Instead, we'll begin with 2004 Citizen Vince. From what I remember, it centered around donuts and some loser named Vince. And I'm skipping ahead. Next up was 2006's The Zero, a National Book Award finalist. This thought-provoking gem immediately sparked a question within me about brotherhood and loyalty. Quote, wonder if I can get my money back on a book that my brother just gave me. And then he jumps ahead, just followed that up in 2009 with Financial Lives of the Poets. After skimming it one evening, I realized just how much I hated finances and poets and reading. That, of course, led to the 2012 blockbuster Beautiful Ruins, a New York Times bestseller for an astounding 69 weeks. It's no doubt Jess's biggest book to date. So big, in fact, that in my house, it continues to prop up my computer monitor. Yeah. Only a brother could write that. And then he goes on to say many other funny things, but then he says, the truth is, I'm Jess's biggest fan. So my first question, Jess, is not to you, but to David. David, know what you know about my sisters? Can you imagine them ever writing anything like that?
Oh my God.
No.
I'm trying to think of the, it would be like Valley of the Dolls with, you know what I mean? Like that's what it would be. And that would be the sister.
Yeah, that would be the nice stuff. Most. Yeah. It would be the accusations of war crimes. That would be the hard part. It would be the really hard part. So The Cold Millions is really fabulous. And I know, Jess, you say you don't write much autobiographically, but this seems to be, it obviously it's set in Spokane in the early 1900s. It's these two brothers who are dealing with, one likes the unions and what they're trying to get done. The other one, Rye, is not so sure. And they encounter all sorts of characters. I mean, I found the book, I don't know if it's Dickensian, I don't know if it's Steinbeck, but all these characters that they encountered, from vaudeville to corrupt politicians to corrupt policemen, it goes on. But it's kind of autobiographical, right? It's what you knew, what you felt, what you've learned and imbued from living and staying in Spokane, right?
I mean, I think autobiographical and personal are very different. It's definitely a very personal book. You know, again, growing up in a working class family, you know, my dad was a union president, a steelworker union president, and we had no church as kids. Our church was the egalitarian fairness of a union that you bring everybody up together. And so that very much informs the book. But then the story that takes over for me, I'd spent the last decade outraged by income inequality, by the fact that that billionaires made $2 trillion during the pandemic, and finding a way to write about that without being didactic, and for me, zeroing in on this period, you know, to hear over and over that we you know, that the economic conditions are like the last gilded, like the end of the Gilded Age, made me want to revisit the Gilded Age, especially that moment in my hometown where there were thousands of indigent workers, of hobos and tramps that were the fuel for the timber and mining industries. And Spokane at that time, 7 railroads are coming through, and the railroad, you know, is of course the internet of its day. This is, there's so much wealth that, but there's also so many of these homeless workers who are looking for work every day. And that the city is doubling in size every 6 years. It's moving from this rough Western frontier town to a modern city. It felt to me like the TV show Deadwood with 100,000 people. And to be, and I just wanted to create that rich environment. And then, yeah, you can get to the personal issues. You can write about, you know, the idealism of youth and the industrial workers of the world, this nascent union that said, you know, at a time when unions were just about as racist and misogynistic as anywhere else, they said women, Black Americans, Native Americans, anyone can join the union if you have a job. And that was revolutionary at its time. So, yeah.
Talk a little bit about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who's one of the nonfiction characters in the book. And I don't know about David and Jamie. I knew of her. I knew she was a leader in the union. Unions. I knew she was an activist. I knew she was a suffragist. I had no idea she was so young.
But I think that was one of the things that really struck me. So the last few years, I've just been so inspired and taken by watching young activists, watching the Parkland shooting survivors, you know, and try to look them in the eye and say, you know, I know, you know, being politically savvy, there's nothing we can do about, you know, weapons of mass, you know, of these machine guns, you know, or the students who walk out for climate change, or the young Black activists who have led the Black Lives Matter protests, being so, watching that youthful idealism, watching it in my kids, I wanted to create, those are the characters I wanted to write a novel about. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn really did leave New York as a 15-year-old, more than a decade before she even had the right to vote, to work as an IWW organizer, go around the country and the West into these rough mining towns and organize workers for fairness. And because I was envisioning this as close to a Western as I would ever write, I kept thinking about those books in which a stranger rides into town. But instead of my stranger being Clint Eastwood, I thought, what if it's a pregnant 19-year-old who's left her husband and is on the street corner, you know, demanding the emancipation of the vagina in 1909? You know,
quote. Jess isn't just saying it's a quote. Yeah.
Almost when I'm writing fiction, I don't, this is really my first historical novel, although Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan are in a book of mine called Citizen Vince, which is about a felon trying to vote in the 1980 presidential election.
According to your brother, it's about donuts, but go ahead.
According to my brother, yeah. And he would know. Yeah. He does know donuts. I'll give him that. This is the first time I've really delved into like a historical period. And so I take my research pretty seriously as an ex-journalist. And so most of the things that Elizabeth Gurley Flynn does and says in the book and the other real characters come from, you know, her book, from the real record, from newspaper stories. And then I try to craft a fictional story around it that, you know, could weave in and out of those real characters.
It sounds like the book is, somewhat pro-union, but at the same time, it also sounds like it resonates with the themes of today about income inequality. Are you concerned at all about the fact that sort of you're writing about unions? It sounds like, I haven't read the book, but I plan to skim it as soon as I can, that you're writing about them in sort of a positive way? Because I asked this, by the way, as a former shop steward. Yeah. At the union at our local, very successful radio station in town, WTOP Radio, one of the most successful radio stations in the country. And I can tell you that negotiating a union contract with a company that's making bucketfuls of money is a lot easier than in some places. But, you know, as the union reps there, we were really proud of the way we were able to make sure we protect the people on the lowest end of the scale. And, you know, protect personal lives and wages and working conditions. But it's a very unpopular thing today. Nobody seems to, unions seem to be fading, and they don't seem to be seen in a very favorable light.
Yeah, I don't think of this as a union novel entirely. I mean, I think the, but, you know, if you come away thinking that the novel, you know, suggests that perhaps the rise of labor in the 20th century helped create a middle class that we've decided shouldn't exist anymore, then I don't think you'd be far off from what I believe, certainly. It really is more of a rollicking adventure story. And again, I chose those young characters for a reason. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn ended up as the chairwoman of the Communist Party USA. You know, I chose young people in 1909 because they shouldn't have to deal with the brutal autocratic regimes of the Soviet Union when talking about collectivism, the Soviet Union and Maoist China. They, you know, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about the idea that why can't we bring everyone else up? Why are there so hundreds and thousands of levels between someone living on the street just trying to get enough food to eat and the mining magnates and robber barons who are running the economy now? And I think that's a fair question. Were there corruptions in unions? Oh my goodness, yes, there were. They were as wildly corrupt as just about any other institution that's ever been created. But does that defeat socialism? Does it defeat collective thinking? I hope not. I hope people are constantly returning to those ideas to look to see what worked, especially young people. So, I'm not too afraid of you know, being tagged a unionist. You know, I'll certainly take it. But I don't think the novel, again, I hope to avoid, you know, talking about whether or not this particular union or that particular union, you know, is effective so much as these broad ideas that you know, really brought about, you know, in the book, they're not fighting for a five day work week. They're fighting for a 6 day work week. They're not fighting for an 8 hour work day. They're fighting for a 10 or 12 hour work day. They're trying to say that 7 year olds might not be the best for factory work, and that if you cut off your fingers, you shouldn't just be thrown out in the street by your employer. You know, the world that existed in that moment was skewed so heavily toward wealth. And in my estimation, it is again. The two characters in the book are named Ryan and Gregory, but their nicknames are Gig and Rye. And I thought it was a Rye comment about the gig economy to call them that.
And they dealt with a guy named Brand, who's the big money guy in the book. He's big business. And again, this is almost verbatim reading from The Cold Millions, and see where, and maybe we can ask you where you got your inspiration for this. Sure. But he spills out a speech to somebody. In this case, it's Detective Delvaux, another great character. And it was just run on phrases. City on the verge, dangers of socialism, East Coast agitators, immigrant filth, real Americans, its support of the police, last stand of decency. Any modern day?
Can't imagine who you're thinking about there. Let me take a wild guess as to who you might be talking about.
It was wild writing this novel about social unrest. And, you know, during this last, you know, summer, like I said, I was drawn to this question of income inequality, and also to a kind of Edenic moment in labor history when the ideas had not been corrupted by Jimmy Hoffa or by, and that to me, I think returning to those moments, returning to those ideals, I long for the day when we were hopeful, you know, it was echoing. I did not have to draw the strings very, very close. the echoes were all around me. And just reading through the newspapers, it was, that at the time, I think of our sort of fractured partisan media as the fairly new thing, but to read newspapers in 1909, you have the labor newspaper, you have establishment newspapers, you have populist newspapers. I had to triangulate many of these events by reading four or five different newspapers.
And that's one of the big myths about journalism is that there was a golden age of journalism that existed at some point just before we got involved, and when the journalism was better. And if you were able to go to the now defunct museum that used to be on Pennsylvania Avenue and went through and look at the history of journalism, it's always been, as Secretary Rumsfeld would have said, untidy.
Yeah. William Randolph Hearst. I don't think I need to say any more, do I? Yeah.
And another was a Hearst paper in Spokane. And it was.
Yeah, sure.
Pretty much say, though, that this is not the golden age of journalism.
No,
I don't know when it was, but it's not right now.
We'll get there.
It was that day we had the company car worked, if I remember right.
Okay.
1987, I believe, was the
golden. That's about right.
A week or two.
Well, I always thought the golden age of CNN was it started in about 1992 when I joined CNN full-time. Mm-hmm. And when I left in 2008, that's when it ended. For me, that was the golden age.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I think that's a fair assessment, yeah.
As somebody who is often a very, very harsh critic of some in the media, I actually think right now, and it may be because the times demand it, right. I think there is some incredible work being done by journalists. There always is, Jamie, but now there is a depth and a breadth and a seriousness of purpose. I think there's some really, really good work being done.
If only anybody believed it.
Really difficult circumstances.
That would help.
But local journalism, small town journalism, the newspapers across the country, I just, breaks my heart because...
It's awful.
Yeah.
You see the story last week in the Times about this entire swath of supposed independent papers around the country, which are really just being astroturfed by, conservative protagonists.
They come up with quasi-legitimate names and pretend to be the Independent Review, etc.
So it's very difficult to find out, to separate the wheat from the chaff these days.
Okay, but I can come up with the upside to that, David. Because there are so many outfits like that with these quasi-legitimate names and websites and this and that, whatever, that is what enables Borat to get the kind of interviews he gets that then become a part of a movie.
I think there's an independent streak that is very, very admirable right now.
All hopefulness, and there it
is. Yeah. Yes.
So I have to say that I watched the first Borat movie on a plane with Lindsey Graham. Coming back from the Munich conference. And I'll just say that we watched the whole thing. And at one point, Borat is in South Carolina pulling some really disgusting prank on some people there. And Lindsay turns to me and says, those are my constituents.
Lindsey Graham can't be making fun of anybody. That's all I'll say. Okay, I want to ask about one really fun character in The Cold Millions by Jess Walter. And then I'm going to get him out with a question. But Jess, Ursula the Great, you've got to describe Ursula the Great. And she responded to an ad actress, calm demeanor required, or something like that, yeah, right?
Yeah, actress, singer, calm demeanor. That was a little rhyme that I created. Yeah, it was wild doing all this research and looking through the vaudeville stages at the time, and I at one point I would have my notebook and I would be staring at microfilm for 7 hours reading old newspapers and reading about these great shows, and I'd be writing my notes, and as I took notes I would sometimes write fictional things in there, but then I would write the real things. And I got home that night and I was looking through my notes and it said Ursula the Great sings and dances with a wild cougar, and I honestly didn't remember if I'd invented that or if I'd read about it. And so after I wrote this character, her name is Ursula the Great, and she sings around this cage. They bring a cage out with a live mountain lion in it, and she has sewn meat into her corset so that when she takes it off, the cat will wait for it. That's the trick of the show.
Oh,
she sings
so
for a while, and then there's a robe in the back of the cage that she puts on after she bears her back to the crowd and throws the corset in. Writing those other voices, bringing them in. One of my favorite novels of all time and of that period is Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow.
Yeah.
And just,
oh, dude, you're in my heart now. Yes. Fantastic book.
Those stories just come together. And you read that novel as if you've just watched a great documentary, but with a soundtrack, you know, it's like the sound of it. And so in the same way, I wanted to create, you know, to honor one of my favorite novels, I wanted to write about that period in the West, but to bring in those voices in much the same way that he brings in, you know, seems to bring in the whole world. You know, I didn't have Houdini to work with, but and so that was...
Ursula is, for me, was one of the, I really, really recommend people get this book, The Cold Moon Is, and you can get very sad. I mean, there are a lot of very, very sad, very tragic elements to the story, but then someone like Ursula, and there are two Ursulas, by the way, has this empathy. And you think the last person in the world from whom we're going to expect this greater purpose is this woman who's in a cage with a cougar, but she has this incredible empathy and kind of carries you through to the next stage.
And I think writing Gurley Flynn, I wanted to write another woman in that time. And her, you know, the very first thing she says, a lot of these characters kind of announce themselves. And you know, she says, a woman owns nothing in this world except her memories, which is a terrible return on investment. And I thought, you know, it's one of the great joys of writing when you don't even know if you've invented a character, if you've researched her, and pretty soon you could feel like you could see her, you could, you know, and watching her through to the end of the novel, you have this real sense of completion of this, you know, this character sort of, you know, finishing the cycle of what they started in the very beginning of the book.
Nice. Okay, let's get you out with... Go ahead, Jamie.
I have two questions for you before you go. Okay, so one of them is your dad. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, how many times have you said to your kids something that my mother's, I think, said to me 100 times, which was, put that stick down, you're going to poke somebody's eye out.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times my mom told
me. I tell my kids I will only be judged by 1960s and 70s style parenting, because you know, my parents were, let's make a cocktail and throw lawn darts. You know, that was...
Lawn darts are the best! My husband and I were just talking about lawn darts the other day, and we tried to find them on eBay.
Olympic sport in my family.
What could possibly go wrong? Let's just let the kids have some metal objects and throw them around.
I was at a friend's house, and they had the latest version of the lawn darts.
Yeah.
And instead of having a pointy end, they had like a big... sort of flat, bulbous
thing. Yeah, it doesn't
thing,
count.
And they glowed in the dark, so you could see them in the dark.
They should not be called lawn darts.
Okay, my other question is...
an actual spear to throw.
So if your brother was writing a blurb for your book, and it had to start with the classic blurb start, which is, if you only read one book this year, how would you complete
actually,
that?
So, well, I told you we roast each other, and
one
of his great jokes was... Jess, if you had to go to a desert island with only one of your books, how would you kill yourself?
That's pretty fabulous.
Yeah, he's done that joke. And he usually works much bluer than that. That's the only joke from my 50th birthday party I can tell.
You could do that on this show. Okay, so here's, we're going to get you out with this. Rye, the younger brother, was a, he was not really a revolutionary, but he's amongst all these revolutionaries, right? It's the early 1900s. If he came back today and you were taking him around Spokane and showing him things and reintroducing, how would Rye see things in 2020?
Well, I don't, it's not giving anything away in the novel to tell you that we last glimpsed Rye in 1964, which is the year before I was born, the year that labor was possibly at its peak. And so the Spokane he saw would, you know, if unless he, if he'd come back anytime after 2000, anytime before about 2010, it wouldn't have looked much different. But one of his sons is an Ayn Rand fan who works for a car lot. And he says of his own son that he's one of those men of fragile confidence who needs to believe he's made his own way in the world. And I love that about Rye, that, you know, he, that in his own son, refuses to acknowledge that his dad's union job had anything to do with his success in the world. I think right now, you know, Spokane, like most Northwest cities, is full of artisanal pork chop places and places that serve drinks that are patterned after after the Volstead Act, after you know, and so I think I think he'd fit right in. You know, I'd take him to one of the fake speakeasies in town, and except for the fact that the drink costs $12, he would I think he would think Spokane had turned out pretty well.
Excellent. Well, everyone should read this book, The Cold Millions by Jess. Hopefully everybody buys it at a local independent bookstore. And I have to do a plug, Jess, because I know you're doing a million events around this book. Yeah. But tomorrow you're doing another virtual event with our friends at One More Page Books in Arlington.
Yes.
Love One More Page Books. They are fabulous people.
Yeah.
David, who did we do there? Will Haygood, right? I think it was Will Haygood.
Oh, yeah. Tigerland, right.
At Tigerland. Yes, it was pouring down rain. David and I could not believe we went across the river to do anything. It
took like 6 hours to get there.
Totally. 6 hours. Had to get the passports out. But now via Zoom, Jess is going to...
long to get up to my event.
Yeah. Exactly.
It takes more than 4 hours. You need faster internet.
So if everybody, if you go online and Google One More Page Books in Arlington, I think just for the price of Jess's book, which is totally worth it, then you can participate in the event tomorrow evening. And it's 7 p.m. East Coast time. Don't get confused, Jess. That's 4 o'clock your time. But those ladies are fabulous. One More Page Books, where we take books, wine, and chocolate more seriously than we take ourselves, which is
very
true.
Should you give the day of the week for those people who aren't listening to this podcast?
Yes, it's Tuesday.
On
it's October
night.
27th.
All right.
Just 1 week before a very important day.
That is tomorrow's
event. We'll be drinking heavily. You're doing a million events around this, Jess. I kept trying to keep up via Google and Twitter, and I couldn't keep up anymore.
I have a tour van. I want to destroy some virtual hotel rooms while I'm out there.
So. Okay, wait, quick question. Because we have our own version of Deserted Island. We'll rope you into it. But New York Times, great review, New Yorker. This book is getting great reviews everywhere. Is Oprah the most important one in terms of sales?
When the first time I landed on the bestseller list, I told my agent I felt like I'd won a beauty pageant that I didn't enter. I honestly don't think about sales that way. So, my book,
for those who can't see, Jesse's blushing right now, which I think
my book of short stories, We Live in Water, was endorsed by President Obama last time. It made his list of favorite books. That I can't really imagine having a reader I'd rather have than that. So not that I wouldn't love Oprah to read it, but having President Obama, you know, tell people that they should read this book of stories about poor people in Spokane, Washington was really a thrill.
Well, David might be able to make that happen because President Obama loves David. He's part of the David Aldrich family.
Where did you get that from?
He's already endorsed me.
I have friends.
Tell him to call me because I want him on my podcast. I've been asking for like 6 months now with no answer.
And hopefully in about a week, he'll have a little more time on his. He's kind of busy.
I want to play him in one-on-one. I want to Reggie Love one of his shots. That's
there you go. Oh, he's loud talking. Oh, yeah, I love
really
it.
He's trash talking. Okay, guys, thanks very much. We are back next week. We are taping the night before the election, and it's kind of our pre-election show.
Why?
Well, because I won't have started drinking too heavily yet.
I am going to be so drunk. I'm just telling you that right now.
Are you doing two versions so one could go depending on what the outcome is?
Yeah. The Tonight Show notwithstanding, we are pretty apolitical here, but next week we have Mike Crowley, who's a great guy. He's a Chatter on Books alum, who is just a fabulous guy who teaches at Denison, and he and another fellow have edited a collection of stories by journalists from flyover country. It's called Midland. It's really wonderful. And they said in the wake of 2016, they said to each other out in Ohio, nobody's paid attention to what's going on in the middle of the country. It's a great collection. And it's a twofer. We also have David Reynolds, who has the latest massive book out on Abraham Lincoln called Abe in His Own Times. Really pretty amazing. And it's all about context, as is Mike Crowley's book. So we will try to be as apolitical as we possibly can be and bring some context to it. But Jamie, thanks for joining us. Okay, here's our deserted island. And we'll try to make this as cheerful as possible. So thinking about Pat Conroy, and I think probably the most famous book, The Great Santini, we've all had a great Santini in our lives. So Jess, I did not give you the homework here. You can be the last one to go. But David, you want to go first? Who's the great Santini in your life?
You know, you asked me this, and really, I wish I had a great Santini. I wish I had something.
Well, that's okay. If you don't, that's okay.
I thought I have many more Lowensteins in my life from the Prince of Tides than I have Santinis.
That's good.
I have confessors who I tell all my secrets to. I don't know. Who is the great Santini in my life? Man.
If you don't have one, that's okay.
You know, I'll say my dad, but my dad was a very, you know, loving,
yeah,
you know, kind of emotional crybaby kind of guy, like he cried at the drop of a hat. But he was tough in the sense that he expected things of you and he demanded things of you, but not in the way where he was very proud of what I did. Like he never said, you're not smart enough, you're not good enough. He always said, hey, that's great, son, you're doing great. So
that
I don't
doesn't
know.
Count. That I don't doesn't know. Count. Jamie?
So being an only child and whose father died when I was very young, it's not my father.
Good.
I have to also confess that much like the classic Leave It to Beaver episode where Beaver doesn't actually read The Three Musketeers but goes and sees the movie. I actually haven't read the book.
But I got a whole Lord Jim story about that, but yeah, go ahead.
So I thought about this, like, well, so, you know, who is it that I might have had a love-hate relationship with, or just somebody that I would be loath to disappoint. Uh-huh. And I sort of took it from that thing. And I had a journalism professor who was Native American at the University of Florida, who was one of these professors. And everybody like hopes, if you're a teacher, you hope to be this person. And if you're a student, you hope to have a professor like this, who just sort of really inspired you. And that you felt like you couldn't fail because they would be disappointed in you. And the fact that they would be disappointing in you would just be too much to take. And that was my professor, Don Grooms at the University of Florida. So that would be, he would be my great Santini.
No surprise, David and Jamie are far more positive than I am. So keeping the journalism theme, as a failed journalism student and as a failed journalist, there was a guy at GW and he's died since, who was, and it took me a while to figure this out, but he was a great Santini. And it was all about making young people, students, feel awful. And you think, when I think back, he was in his early 40s. And the early, if you're in your early 40s, and it's the early 80s, and you're a journalist, but you're teaching, it means you're a loser, right? You couldn't have a job.
That was
a thriving industry then.
Right.
And he couldn't get a real job.
Those who can't teach, and those who can't teach, teach
exactly. Zed. And he couldn't.
That's the joke, right?
He couldn't teach either, so he abused. And he would, in front of your peers, when you were alone, he would tell you that was awful, that was terrible. I was actually working at the time and producing stuff, bad stuff, for the Washington Star at the time.
Of course,
he couldn't
have
been.
Of course, you were.
He couldn't have been meaner or nastier. And when I think about it, I survived it because I survived it, and screw you. And I had mean older sisters, so you couldn't do anything to me. But I think about the lives that he must have ruined because he was such an abusive, sick guy.
Yeah.
And he's dead, and I don't feel badly about that. Oh, Jess, we kind of talked
terrible.
About. It's terrible.
My dad has some Santini aspects to him, but he was an incredibly sweet guy. So, but to stick with the journalism theme, I would go with someone who was really tough on me, but always in such a, one of my first editors, and she would say things like, you write description really well, now pick one, and then turn away, go back to writing. because I would over-describe so much.
Very good. That's really good.
Oh, that's great.
That's really good.
It is. It's. I mean, I have to tell you, it's. I think about it all the time now. I'll look at a sentence and I'll think, I'm overloading this sentence. I need to pick one.
Nice.
And people really are going to get one, you know, detail from a sentence often anyway. So it was such great advice.
But my editor used to say to me, Jamie, you're overdrawn at the cliche bank.
Now that's more Santini like.
Yes.
But the other thing she said in my job review, she said, when Jess chooses to wear socks, he can exude a quiet professionalism, which I think was her way of saying I should wear socks.
That's a great line.
Great professionalism.
Yeah. So,
but yeah, we're in a pandemic. You don't have to wear socks or pants or anything.
Yeah, she was a very dry, the dry Santini was what
nice. All right, well, the great
Before
Santini.
Before we did this tonight, by the way, my wife, Roberta, came down to check that I had pants on.
Oh, thank you, Roberta.
Just because she doesn't want any sort of mishap that would result in a career ending.
We don't want to tube in anybody, even though nobody's looking at this, right?
All right, guys. As ever, Claude, thank you for doing all the important work. Dave and Jamie, thanks for joining us. Jess, I mean, just an honor, a privilege. It's fabulous work. I really hope everybody buys the Cult Millions. Holidays are coming up. It's a great gift. And we hope you keep writing, and we hope you come back sometime.
I'd love to. Yeah, I'll be back to talk NBA. So
anytime, sir.
Take care.